welcome to the second episode in our two-part miniseries on Richard Blanshard. In this episode, we shift our focus onto the relationship between the indigenous peoples of British Columbia and the Hudson's Bay Company during the transformative period of the 1830s to the 1850s. This period was tumultuous, to say the least. We see an expansion of the fur trade and of colonial ambitions, and the increasing presence of European settlers. In this episode, Barry unpacked some of the challenges that indigenous communities faced as they attempted to reconcile their traditional way of life with the rapidly evolving geopolitical landscape that lay before them. Barry touches on the complex interplay between indigenous agency and the policies that were enacted by the Hudson's Bay Company, and offers some insight into the dynamics of power, negotiations, and cultural exchange during this really important era of Canadian and British Columbian history. We hope you enjoy, and now on to our second part of our Richard Blanshard series.
The story of the colony of Vancouver Island and its First Nations or Indigenous politics and history lied very deeply in the struggles between the Northwest Company and the Hudson Bay Company. And in 1821, because of the violence in Athabasca, the companies had been merged under threat and were the merger was consolidated by Parliament in 1821 under terms of union. And under this, it was a statutory measure known as an Act for Regulating the Fur Trade. It authorized a license, renewable for 21 years, for the sole and exclusive privilege of trading with the Indians over the whole of British North America, not being part of the lands or territories heretofore granted to the Hudson, the company and governor and company of adventurers trading into Hudson Bay, and not being part of any of our provinces in North America. That license was issued on the 5th of December, 1821. Let me uncouple that for you. The Hudson Bay Company had Rupert's Land already as its own territory. West and south of Rupert's Land was land which had not yet been firmly given to Britain by sovereignty. And sovereignty, as it works itself out in North America, is not related to some doctrine of discovery. It's related to actual occupation. And this is what 1846 means in far Western history, that the sovereignty is acquired by mutual agreement of the United States and Great Britain as they carve up the final realm. To the south, of course, the United States have had another arrangement with Mexico of a different order. Now, the new requirement under the license I mentioned reflected the then current thinking, which specified that the company was obligated to provide for the moral improvement and religious instruction of the indigenous peoples. The monopoly could now, with the blessing of government, extend its control to the Pacific. And that license was extended indefinitely in 1827. It's important to note that one of the reasons why this license and organization was established was because of the use of liquor by the two companies in rivalry up in Athabasca, and the great rivalry that was going on and violent rivalry that was going on between the two companies in Athabasca. Now, we all know in Canada about the problems that were going on in Red River in 1816. But in 1821, the big fight was up in Athabasca. And the news of this reached London, and the Colonial Office and the government put a stop to it by this legal arrangement. It's an extraordinary affair of how the destinies of Northern North America and all its people were being directed by Westminster and by Whitehall. Now, the company was surely no philanthropic organization. It was a business run by the governor, deputy governor, seven managing directors or committee in London. Its object was to provide dividends to stockholders. There were 100 shares, 60 of which their owners retained for themselves, and the remaining 40 were divided among the chief traders and chief factors who managed the affairs in what was called the Indian country. A chief factor held 2 shares, a chief trader 1, and these were commissioned officers, and they received the proceeds of the shares allotted to them, but were not to bear their share in the losses the company might sustain, which is a very good arrangement because it meant that they were cushioned from losses in their own immediate locale. The company was a collection and distribution agency. Furs were gathered, manufactured goods, blankets, ironwork, firearms, cutlery, beads, trinkets, finery of various sorts, rum and brandy, did I mention tobacco, were distributed. And in keeping with government policy, and as a token measure of the improving instincts of the times, the board, and I quote, expressed concern for the spiritual and material welfare of the Indian population, in particular for their conversion to Christianity and their protection from the scourge of alcohol. That dates from the early 1820s. Sir George Simpson, Little Empire, said that, tongue-in-cheek, he said that philanthropy was not the only consideration that the company was interested in. And surely that was true. But in any case, the company men in the field had to seek peace with the tribes. They kept well clear of intertribal violence. That is to say, if one First Nation, Indian Nation, was fighting another, they would stay well out of it. But when there was a case of murder of a trader or piracy of traders' goods, then the HBC stepped in. I like to call this the policy of mutual intervention. The idea was that they would keep a distance from the First Nations, but they would keep them in a sort of a debt slavery because they would advance them their goods and possessions and chattels for the trading year, perhaps traps or ammunition, gunpowder, clothing, things to put on their feet and their hats and so forth, food even. They would advance this sort of this as credit. They would supply them with all their needs. And then from year to year, the system would go on without trial, without fail, without change. And do you know that even if the person who was receiving the credit on the for the work on the trap line came home empty-handed, they would nonetheless be given credit the next year round. There was no failure system. The company kept this going, and this was therein lay their secret, because there were no or very few revolts on the frontier from the indigenous side of things. Now, the British had another interest. They had this tremendous surplus population. And they were sending them to South Africa, Australia, New Zealand, and many went to the United States, of course. But the surplus population was considered to be a source, maybe, for Vancouver Island's population. But in point of fact, the Hudson Bay Company controlled that very, very carefully. They selected everybody who went out there. They had to have the proper money to go out there. They had to take their own laborers with them, in some cases their own equipment, their own cricket equipment, their own tools, their own clothing, and so forth. And a self-developed, self-well-heeled, independent traders were farmers, were yeoman farmers is the right term, were the ones that were looked for. The people like Edward Langford, for instance, these were the people who had become the heads of the company's big farms at Cowlitz and at Nisqually and in Vancouver Island at a place called Cloverdale, as one example. And there were a number of settlements and forts up and down the coast. They were all tied together by a wonderful marine detachment, which consisted and was headed up by, first of all, the SS Beaver of famous memory, and then a few years later by the Otter, which is a propeller-driven ship, and by barks and schooners and the vessels that trawled back and forth from Victoria Harbor to the London and the Thames River on an annual basis, and to guard against some problems that might occur out here if a ship were lost coming out around the Horn or getting stuck in the Columbia River, as was once the case. They always plan to have a full year's supply in advance, so that against any possibility. This is their insurance policy. The essential factor in the peace that was exhibited on this vast frontier was the practice of Hudson Bay Company officers and servants taking indigenous or mixed blood wives. We know from superb research into the lives of commissioned officers in the field. Sylvia Van Kirk and Jennifer Brown were leaders, and there are others who followed them, that martial connections were made with high-ranking females. So it was with James Douglas, Roderick Finlayson, William Henry McNeil, John Todd, and others. These were relations in the custom of the country. Later, the marriages were solemnized under company rules instituted in 1833, but the social continuum of these mixed blood families continued. Many relationships in Victoria Harbor history are of this sort, and in effect, the females and their children lived what has been described as colonized lives. And how could it have been otherwise? The first bride ship did not arrive in Victoria's Harbor until the year 1861, and by then the power base of the company was being weakened by changing circumstances, not least the 1858 gold rush, which altered the demographics considerably. Still, the indigenous and mixed blood women lived influential lives, as did their offspring. James Douglas once put it beautifully when he said that the traders and the indigenous people were tied together by many tender ties, and that has been frequently quoted from James Douglas. Now, other servants had their unique places in the strict hierarchical system. Clerks were in high demand. The company recruited laborers almost exclusively in the Orkneys. They were steady and useful. It was a curious thing, observed one person, how numerous Scotsmen are in the wilds of North America. As a rule, those in the employ of the company in the field were a hard-headed and hard-beaten lot with strong survival instincts. They were tough business practitioners. They'd worked their way up into managerial positions. It is a fact that the Scottish caste has been very strongly established in Canada. And this is absolutely directly owing to the two fur trade companies that I mentioned, the Northwest Company and the Hudson Bay Company. Now, as a rule, the Hudson Bay Company ship captains were also a tough, brawny, and hard-drinking set. They faced the perils of Cape Horn or storm-tossed lee shores of Vancouver Island and the Northwest Coast with courage. Some of them were lost at sea. Many of their ships went down as well. They were ever on the alert against pirates and indigenous raiders. The deckhands were a hardened breed, but liable to desert when rumors of gold were about. At any one time, the Hudson Bay Company had about six vessels. Some of them plied the inner waters down to Puget Sound, the Strait of George and Victoria. Others went over to the Sandwich or Hawaiian Islands, taking shingles and salted salmon, or going up to Sitka, Alaska, with wheat, which had been milled in Victoria or going down to California with supplies or financial reasons for that purpose. Now, in London, very briefly, the whole project was run by this company of gentlemen and adventurers of England trading into Hudson Bay, which had been established in the year 1670. So a remarkable firm with a remarkable history. Sir George Simpson was the governor of Rupert's Land, and he was based at Lachine on the St. Lawrence. And he was governor-in-chief of all Hudson Bay Company territories in America. He was the all-seeing, all-powerful field general, bringing economy and structure to the Columbia Department. The little emperor was a stickler for appearances and balanced accounts. He traveled extensively over his quasi-sovereign possession, an intriguing fellow, no doubt, a master of bold strategies, a martinet. He took notes on how to make systems more efficient or otherwise redundant. He kept a secret inquisitorial character book, and into this he put down his pungent remarks about the chief factors and kept them all in code so nobody could tell what his own human resources analysis was. Nowadays, when big corporations are run by human resources department, it's very interesting to think one man ran the whole show of all of Canada. On the eve of the Oregon Treaty, he achieved mastery of the far western trade. He promoted Dr. John McLaughlin at Fort Vancouver. He backed Peter Skeen Ogden, the great trader and explorer. He preferred and developed as one of his great personages, James Douglas. But Douglas also felt the power of his despotism. In information gathering, Simpson had no rival. He demanded obedience. James Douglas learned that duty was the first thing that he must attend to in the running of his empire out here in the far west. He was the sub factor of the empire of the far west, but to put it in common parlance, Sir George Simpson called the shots. Now, the Columbia Department, to which Simpson gave special attention, was an imperial domain of impressive dimensions. I call it informal empire. On its borderlands, it was maintained by out-trading American rivals on the south and Russians on the north. This monopoly undercut American free enterprise in the Snake River Basin. The American mountain men and companies fought among themselves, and unregulated relations developed with the tribes. The HBC, by contrast, as the U.S. Superintendent of Indian Affairs put it, acted quickly when any trader showed improper conduct. As he said, the British maintained a stability and orderliness in their regulated commerce with indigenous people in a rather despotic yet salutary way. The Hudson Bay's interest was profit, and profit could best be realized by keeping the peace in the frontier areas. Best remembered in Hudson Bay Company were the company officers who dominated the conflict. Or as somebody put it, conflict is the stuff from which history is written. The fur trade suffered when lumbermen or farmers arrived. In Oregon, settlers destroyed the fur business. James Douglas was referring to the Willamette settlers when he wrote, "The interests of the colony and the fur trade will never harmonize. The fur trade must suffer by each innovation." But his words could be generally applied. Peter Skeen Ogden expressed similar views to Simpson, and to his way of thinking, the old order would give way to the new only with the disruption in race relations. Douglas and Ogden were energetic officers with high qualities. They were the best, in my opinion, of those who worked in the far west. Now, there were others, laborers, other persons who were in the system. There were the mariners, the bakers, the master pilots, the marine engineers, the carpenters, the other artificers. The blacksmiths were in high demand, including dynamiters. For the Hudson Bay Company brought the blasting cap to Vancouver Island and it irretrievably changed the face of this rock-bound island. There were many French Canadians or Canadiens among the laborers and couriers, and a hard-drinking, God-fearing set they were. They were pleased to see at Fort Victoria the arrival of the Oblate priest, Father Lempret, in June of 1849. Because these Canadiens were invariably Roman Catholic, and the blessings of baptism and marriage were brought by the Roman Catholic priest. Understandably, the Hudson Bay Company kept well out of this. They had their own colonial church, their own colonial chaplain. They only educated Hudson Bay Company people who lived within the fort. They only fed Hudson Bay Company people who were inside the fort. So this was outside the fort, you're on your own. Inside, you're one of us. This is a very important breakdown in arrangements or division in arrangements. Now, some of the laborers were Kanakas or Sandwich Islanders or Hawaiians, and they were worked hard as fort's laborers. They were strong and muscular. They were great at as boats persons, boatsmen, and they were always kept the guard at night, and they were steadily employed in that capacity. They were powerful among the indigenous peoples of Camosun Harbor, and their one of the chiefs, the senior chiefs, and he signed the Fort Victoria Treaty, was a chap called Chialfuck, who, because of his frizzy hair, was called King Freezy by the whites. So we have a development of Kanakas or Sandwich Islanders right here at that particular time. The French Canadians and the Métis were the fort construction crews. They built everything on a square timber basis with pegs. Didn't have iron, didn't have nails. They did have a blacksmith to fashion things like hinges and door handles and so forth, but by and large, they used wood at every turn. And of course, Vancouver Island at Esquimalt and at Victoria and Nanaimo had more timber than they could possibly use at that time. So a sawmill was put up to begin to sell timber, and that was became a new export. It developed also at Souk, and by 1848, late in the year, there were 300 acres under tillage as the laborers got to work. So in summary then, Fort Victoria becomes the nexus of the new enterprise. It was a typical Hudson Bay Company fort. It was on the southwest corner. There was a bastion, three-story tall, with some six-pounder black muzzle cannons protruding from it. And there was this long, long gallery on the inside of the palisade. There was the Hudson Bay Company flag was flying in the breeze there, the old red duster with the HBC on the background. There was a belfry with a bell in it, which would announce when food was served or if there was a fire to be attended to, and somebody would look after that. All the palisaded property poles were brought from Mount Douglas or Pickles, then in those early days called Cedar Hill by the whites, and they were large logs that were hauled at very great distance to make the perimeter of the whole thing. There was no church, but they had church services in the large great hall. When the bell rang, dogs in the native village across Fort Victoria put up a shrill howl. The buildings were sort of in a Spanish brown and white wash, and it was a not imposing or a pretty place. I don't think forts are, generally speaking, pretty places, They are, however, what one person described as compressed places of power, really focal points of authority. There's authority in arms and ammunition, in guns, in military capacity. It's a fortress of defense. It's a place where all the money is kept. It's the place where the trading goes on. And those on the inside are on one side of the frontier, and those on the outside are on the other side of the frontier. It's an outpost, if you wish to call it. The interior walls of the Great Hall were festooned with taxidermist wares, heads of various wild creatures of the forest, like all the great four-legged creatures of the Northwest, as well as probably a taxidermy shop showing all sorts of wildlife and wildfowl. It was indigenous regalia and antique weapons. And Douglas and his family lived upstairs in the Great Hall, and Trader Finlayson had to live by the gate at the counting house. The western gate of the fort opened on the inner harbor and a landing stage. The back gate led to Fort Street and to swamps and meadows, rising parkland and rocky outcrops. A track led through the grounds from Wharf Street to Fort Streets, and in order to avoid the mud while walking across the yard, one had to negotiate a walkway consisting of two or three poles laid side by side. Enclosed within the stockade stood a combined barracks and a new arrivals building, a temporary measure. But it's certainly true that the accommodations facing these people on their arrival after a voyage of months around Cape Horn were extraordinarily atrocious. And Governor Blanchard, when Mrs. Langford arrived and she was about ready to give birth to a child, he was absolutely shocked by when he assessed the nature of what the Hudson Bay Company was doing to look after their new arrivals. He was absolutely shocked at the circumstances. And he had Lady Mrs. Langford brought into his house with their whole family. And the first child to the Langford family born in Vancouver Island was born in the governor's house. The Hudson Bay Company were not a hotel agency. They would provide food. They would have the essentials in readiness, but they never went out on their own. They were assuming that the new arrivals would look after themselves as quickly as possible, and they would. The other thing was the Hudson Bay Company would assume they would put them to work, and they saw all the people who arrived around Cape Horn and say the Harpooner or the Norman Morrison. These are the emigrant ships on the annual basis. They put them to work as soon as possible, and it didn't matter whether you were a skilled coal miner like the Muir family or Robert Dunsmuir, you'd be put together and put to work just to gather up stones and clear the slash, burn the slash, square up the logs, etc., etc. So in short, just before Governor Blanchard arrives, which is in March of 1850, there weren't any houses outside the forts, saving a big storehouse and the beginnings of Chief Factor Douglas's residence. All the officers and men, there were about 70 of them in number, lived securely inside the palisade with locks, doors locked tight every night, and the watchman set. With shiploads of settlers expected imminently, Finlayson, a trader, and his constructors were building two large unheated dwellings outside the palisade. These were to house temporarily any immigrants or hired artificers, men, miners, or laborers who survived the fateful Cape Horn passage from England of 18,000 miles and were cast down on Camosun Inlet's rocky shores. There they had to face whatever nature or the Hudson Bay Company could provide. Those who had the good fortune to reside within the palisade were either company servants and their families or guests. Other arrivals had to fend for themselves beyond the picketed enclosure. If you were not under contract to the company, you were on your own. So this is the circumstances. This is a very rough, a very rude, a very difficult situation for immigrants. And moreover, the company is not partial to encouraging settlement and developing the amenities of life out here on the margins. It was self-help and arrival beware.